Welcome to the Thinklings Podcast, a conversation where good thoughts help renew the mind with the Word of God. You're here with Tim, Charlie, Andy, and Josh. Welcome to the conversation.
Well, I watched StarCraft on occasion.
Let's go.
My lunch hour.
We're already recording.
No, we are.
Hey! It caught your comment about StarCraft.
Oh, man.
Welcome to the Thinklings Podcast. A morning where we have not a lot of time, but we're still going to podcast because it's important.
We're one member down.
Yes.
So Josh is not here today. So listeners, you know, be sure to send him a message saying you're sad that he's gone. He had an issue. He was on the way out.
Coffee.
Yeah, I know. That's what I was thinking. Maybe we should do coffee first and then I'll talk about Josh. I'll just real quick tell about Josh. So yeah. He has a cat and he was letting his cat out this morning and the neighbor's dog totally freaked his cat out.
Oh, boy.
But the neighbor's dog is a little tiny chihuahua, but this cat that Josh has is the biggest scared thing ever. And so his cat ran away. And
he's so horrendous.
He was like five blocks out when he texted us. And so anyways, you can just, hopefully he gets his cat back. So, all right, let's talk about this coffee.
Hey, it's important.
It is. Know? Yeah. Hopefully he gets his cat
back. So what are we drinking?
So horrendous.
What's wrong, Tim?
This is coffee. What is it? What do you think it is?
It feels very earthy and dark.
I would say it has like I don't know if it's a Sumatra, but I always associate Sumatra with like a plant or a grass or but that doesn't always work because that's like Indonesia. So it is plantish. Let me take another sip. It is roasty, at least a city roast, I would imagine.
Yeah, I feel very medium-y.
It's not. It's, oh man, it does have a punch to it. It's,
I feel like a medium to dark Ethiopia.
Yep. You know what? It almost reminds me of, this is not a slam, but Starbucks's like house blend. Or no, they're Pike Street.
Pike?
Yeah, they're Pike roast. Okay. Have you had Pike before? I drink that for quite a while, and it's got, there's like a, I don't know.
Sometime I think we ought to like bring in that Pike, or I don't know. There's like the Starbucks French roast downstairs. The stuff is horrid.
Oh, we should do that. That would be interesting.
And then you'd be able to tell us the difference between this and that.
No, this is
not that bad.
No, it's not bad.
I'd give it a 4.5 to 6.
I don't know what region.
On a scale.
I want to say Mexico. Number. But I don't think that's right. So
what are we
I'm going to guess Indonesia somewhere.
So when Dr. Paul and I went to Cedarville, we stopped in Galesburg, Illinois, and there was a small
Galesburg
named Innkeepers.
Oh, no way.
Yeah. And so got a full mug and it was quite good.
Yeah.
And so I'm like, so what is this? And so he said, well, it's the Mexican.
No way.
Oh.
And
you're kidding.
He calls it a medium.
Okay.
And I thought it was a medium.
Yeah. I don't think it's a full dark.
He said it was a light, but the bag said medium. And when I looked at the beans, I'm like, no, this is a little more of a medium than it is a light. Yeah.
For like a medium dark, this is a bueno.
It's not
cup
bad.
Of coffee.
It's pretty good.
That's, I think, the first time I've guessed it right.
I think so.
I love it.
We're bad at it. That's okay. I don't know how scientific it even really is. So, I mean, a bean's a bean. All right, so we're done with that.
All right, well, we're ready for the next
Books and Business.
Books and Business. I'm going to go first.
Woo.
So I have no idea when this will post, but I was invited as guest onto the Inklings Variety Hour hosted by Chris Pipkin. Inklings.
Way to go,
Thinklings.
Man.
It's good stuff there. But they more or less just working themselves through a lot of the Lewis Tolkien legendarium and all of that. And so we talked about I've always called it Farmer Giles, but apparently it's not Giles. It's Giles.
That's what I thought it was.
Aegidius.
I figured you were saying it the correct way and I was wrong.
No. Yeah.
Okay.
And that's, so as is said in Farmer
Giles.
I'm
2 for 2 today on the podcast.
it's essentially like a comedic pun of Latin. Like lots of like titles of things are just like plays on words. And if you don't know Latin and Greek, you won't pick them up. And I know a little Greek, so I caught some of them. Like there's a giant that stomps on Galathea the cow, and Galathea's the goddess of milk is the name of the cow. So yeah, anyway, so, but as it says in the book, you know, give something in Latin and it's like, and here's the translation for those of the vulgar tongue, English.
That's great.
So I am one of vulgar tongue. I don't know Latin.
Which vulgar means common. Yeah. And so that's.
Or vulgar.
Well, also that.
I too. Should take a look at that. That might be really fun for like my kids that are learning Latin and even my wife as she teaches it to the CC There's crew.
Interesting. And it's a fun story to begin with. You'll catch it's a little bit more bippity boppity than The Hobbit and Lord of the Rings. So it kind of shows you a little bit more
bippity boppity
side of Tolkien. Yeah. It's more in the zone of like a Mr. Bliss or, you know, Smith of Wooten Major.
That clarifies everything.
But yeah. So that I was reading that recently and that podcast will post at some point, and when it does, I'll put it in the show notes. But
boom. That'll be fun.
Farmer Aegidius. Of Hamo.
Kyle Giles of
Hamo.
De Hamo. Bueno.
Bueno. Last week I taught Ecclesiastes. And so two of the assignments that I added, I added them. Yeah. They had to, intertextuality is like, how does the Bible quote itself? It's kind of a big deal right now. I don't know. Everybody's like intertextuality, this and that and whatever else. And I feel like they're reading a whole pile of texts together that are just developing the same theological idea. Like if you have two texts that are developing the same theological idea, what would you expect?
They would sound similar. Maybe even come to the same conclusion.
Yeah, exactly. So,
when two Christians study the same passage and quote.
Right. So there's a whole series of books reading Ecclesiastes intertextually, reading Job intertextually. So I had my students read two articles from these two books. The one was Job and Ecclesiastes, Intertextuality and a Protesting Pair. So if you think through Job and Ecclesiastes, you know, they're kind of similar ideas. You know, life is, you know, Hevel, you can't figure it out, and everybody dies and then they're forgotten. So what would be some correspondences? The author kind of develops a theory of intertextuality in the beginning, which I thought was helpful, which is why I assigned it. And he writes, the establishment of literary dependence and the determination of the direction of borrowing are notoriously difficult. In other words, who's borrowing from who? And that can be a big question. But if you're thinking Job and Ecclesiastes, which one was written first?
Job.
Yeah, I mean, everybody thinks that Job was written first. That one shouldn't be really too a controversy. Hard for us. Right. Even the higher critics would assign an earlier date to Job. So, especially given disputed compositional histories of the individual books within the Hebrew canon, and that too, so number two, a reader will respond to obvious verbal correspondence regardless of its nature and origin. So the expectation is that a reader is going to pick up on it. And that's another one of the questions. Will a reader be able to figure this out? So they had to read these two articles. And kind of funny that most of my students were very critical of both of the intertextual connections between the articles. Job and Ecclesiastes, there's not a whole lot of intertextuality between the two. And then the other one was Ecclesiastes and the New Testament. Where is the New Testament? Where does the New Testament quote Ecclesiastes? That one was written by Craig Bartholomew, which I like him. And the one is that's pretty clear is Romans chapter 3. Paul states that there's not a just man on earth who does not sin, which seems to be a pretty clear reference to Ecclesiastes 7. Okay, so why is Paul quoting it in Romans 3?
Because everyone sins.
Because everybody's sinning, and he's trying leveling to establish. He's establishing that from the Old Testament. Do you see how intertextuality is functioning there? Well, but then, how profound or difficult is that to understand?
But he's also quoting. He's quoting Psalms all over the place and Proverbs in that one section. Exactly. So it's not surprising that he's in more Solomonic Davidic.
Right.
Whatever.
And so then the more controversial one is in chapter 8. He talks about the futility of the earth, and the word that's used corresponds with the vanity word. So the Greek Septuagint translates. That's the more controversial one, and we had some good discussion about it. So my books today, reading Job intertextually and reading Ecclesiastes intertextually, I'm done.
Ranking it. You're just saying not really
that's
a ranking
what I've
on
been
this
reading
one.
And something, yeah.
All right. So you said in that interaction, you were talking about a protesting pear.
Yeah.
And so I just finished Me, Myself, and Bob. And so I literally thought of a VeggieTale.
Oh, boy.
A protesting
pear. It's an intertextual
pear.
Connection.
Between the two books.
Were
Look exactly. at Tim making a cultural reference. Sort of. It's like within our field. So, listener, I finished Me, Myself, and Bob, and I loved it. And so I'm just going to give a quick review of it. Charlie has lost it. Charlie's done. He is done. He can't go. He can't even at the moment. So finished reading Me, Myself, and Bob by Phil Vischer, his autobiography telling the story of his rise and fall of the VeggieTales. And I would say this was one of the most interesting, fun biographies I've read in a long time. I also was a little surprised at the value of the last third of the book. It was not what I was expecting. So as a former evangelical from a broader evangelical context, as he was narrating his ascending success of VeggieTales, so he barely had any money. He could barely afford the supercomputer to animate, but he knew how to do it. He pieced stuff together in his parents' basement when he was young. They get their first VeggieTales video produced. And do you guys remember, if you watched it, the Silly Songs with Larry section? That was just because they were trying to find something else to fill up a 30-minute segment. And one of his buddies is like singing a silly song about losing something. And he's like, well, it was like, where's my razor? Because he was like trying to shave. And they thought it'd be weird to sing a song about that to kids, because then the kids are going to find razors, you know? So they changed it to hairbrush. And it's just lots of really interesting background stuff. He only had like three people working for him. He had to render and switch the memory tapes for 4 days straight continuously to make his first deadline. He didn't sleep for like 97 hours. Got the recorded master tape to the producer, and then he went and slept. They're really great stories.
Yeah.
But by the time his second VeggieTale video comes out, he's got 10 employees and they're moving in a good clip. But then he kept saying, I really wanted to have a bigger impact for God. So I had to get bigger. I had to figure out how can I sell more videos. And as I'm reading that, I'm thinking, that's not, no. You don't need to do that. Just be faithful. And so he makes a concession in how he runs his business so he can be bigger. And then he gets bigger, and then he makes another concession and another concession. And I keep saying, dude, you shouldn't be doing this. And at one point he recognized, I think I may have already said this, that in his company of like 50 people, they had hired so many unbelievers just to
keep going
and keep getting bigger, that he started to feel uncomfortable talking about the Lord in his own workplace. But when he would travel the country, he would only talk about the Lord and the problems with entertainment today and the wickedness. And he essentially was trying to become, and I didn't catch this, a Christian Disney. And he wanted to be a Christian Walt Disney. So he had read a Walt Disney biography. He loved animations and all that. So he ascends, but in ascending, he's making all kinds of concessions. And I'm like, this is typical evangelical logic, and it's really bad. Like, why is he doing this? So then it gets to the pinnacle where they rent out this massive venue that's like a mile from Disney in like California or Florida, one of the two. And they have this really big party as they release this one VeggieTales video, and it's to great acclaim. And the entire time the big event's going on, he knows the next day they're going to have to lay off like 2/3 of their staff. They don't have any money. There's a lawsuit going. He got in a lawsuit with the people who owned Barney, because the original guy who owned Barney was sort of a Christian trying to promote values. And then when he died, this other company took it over as a big legal thing. Well, that legal thing ultimately tanks Big Idea Incorporated, which is his story. So he has these, I just love the way he writes. He has the beginning of the end as a chapter, the middle of the end as a chapter, and the end of the end. And it tells the whole story arc. And so then he talks about just being completely destroyed. Go ahead.
So that's the part that I would like to read, because I heard about, so hearing his perspective on the end. So
what did you hear about?
Well, just that there was a lawsuit and that they lost the lawsuit and that they didn't have the money to pay for it. And so then they just sold out to like a big, huge parent company or something.
Yep. It was Hit Media. So if you've ever watched any Thomas the Trains and there's like that little cube, that's them. And Lyric was sold to Hit. And then it was some big problem. I think your business side of you, Tim, you'd really enjoy this part of the book. But in the end, and I'll try to make this quick because I know we're short on time. He goes back, and I didn't see this coming, and he did a great job, and disagrees with himself on almost every point of evangelical logic that I thought. And it was really, really good. And so he described his being crushed in his pride and how much God had to crush him, the same as Eustace being undragoned. He says it's just like in the story where Eustace tries to undragon himself and he can't, and Aslan has to come and do it. So that was a really interesting point. He said there's one chapter where he talks about having a big effect and how he wanted to have it right away, but he wasn't interested in walking with the Lord and he missed that part of it. And so then when this whole thing crushed, he just basically started reading the Bible copiously all day long. He just read the Bible for 6 months. And in it, he noticed that Noah was righteous, walking with the Lord for 500 years before God started to use him in his ministry. And so he realized, oh, I should have just been humbly walking with God, putting out a couple of videos, caring for my family. It was a horrible work atmosphere. He was trying to grow so fast that internally he was hemorrhaging people. So it was really great. The end of it was very good. I would agree with almost all of the things he said about this is what you need. You don't need to be big. You need to follow the Lord. You need to be holy. You need to love God. It was actually a really good end, and I thought it was very, very good. His new company that he built was called Jellyfish. And he said, we had a new company called Jellyfish. He says, jellyfish are cute and they're sort of silly, but there's a deeper meaning. Jellyfish can't locomote, like they can't move. They just have to go with the waves, like wherever the waves take them. And he said, what he wanted to do is be faithful to God and let God take him wherever. So I thought it was really good. So I'm going to rank it. And I think I'm going to rank it on our system. It's a recommend. It's not like you need to buy it. But it's also not the highest recommend. So instead of a 7, I'm going to give it a 6. I think it's really good. The only thing where in my mind, I'm like, I don't know about this, is if you go to Phil Vischer today on social media, he's pretty woke. He's very anti-Trump. Someone said, why didn't you talk about Biden this way for 4 years? And he said, because Biden didn't claim to be a Christian and I don't expect him to be a Christian. But I think that's a cop-out. If you're going to get that politically active, you should be saying something about the other side. No one thinks Trump is the paragon of evangelical belief. So I would say where he's at today, I'm not sure. So don't take that as a clarification of him, don't take that as a support of him. But also, I think the lessons he learned were exactly what you're going to learn if you took the evangelical logic. And so I really appreciate it. So rank it 6. I would recommend it. I think you'd enjoy it.
Awesome. Yeah, that does sound interesting. Do you think I should read it?
I think you would. I think you would enjoy it. Even depending on the narrator, you might enjoy it on your drives.
Yeah.
But I mean, I really think because it's a creative activity and because he's trying to be in ministry, there's enough crossover. It'd be super, super. It's one of those, you're doing like intertextual stuff and then throw that in the mix. It's really nice.
Well, I already have a check out there for Nightingale. So,
yep. Well, I put this ahead of Nightingale. I mean, the Nightingale trilogy, I do think it's good. But this one was...
We're going to all read it together. Tim wants to. So.
Tim's I'm not going to about...
All right.
Don't listen to it. Just don't listen to
them. Let's have a conversation.
I'm so excited.
About Jacob the Dunker. So this is part 3. We're going to conclude the series. And so we'll have a little bit of review here and then some new ground. There'll be a lot of quotes in this one. I did, as much as I can call academic research of the topic. So I have some old resources that I found online, have some fun quotes. To go back, received a Bible that's about 125 years old, has a name written in it, Jacob Henry Brower. And so it's like, who was this guy? And so we start tracking it back, and we started in part one talking about the Reformation, and then in the wake of that, or in that same time period, the 30 Years' War in Europe. So this is 1550, 1650, in that kind of zone. And we talked about Martin Luther, and then out of the Protestant Reformation and the Lutheran ideas, you have the German Pietists, who kind of start coming up with their own religious ideas, very anti-formal religion. We talked a little bit about them. Part two, that's where we bridge into this idea of Dunker or Tunker, which that's a German word for baptize. And we would maybe call them the German Baptist Brethren, where we talked about guys Spener, Arndt, and Franck, and the German Pietists, and how that kind of overlaps with Anabaptists as a general heading, where people are rebaptizing people rather than the infant baptisms or, you know, creedal formal baptisms of the state church. People are believing, and well, the New Testament tells us to baptize someone upon the confession of their faith. So in that group, we talked about Alexander Mack in Neuwied Germany, along with Ernst Holkmann. And these Alexander Mack would be the unquestionable starter and leader of the Brethren Church. And we talked in part two about how they then come over to America, into Pennsylvania, Germantown, Pennsylvania. Peter Becker would be the first pastor of a Germantown congregation. And then, and this is in the early 1700s. And then 1729, Alexander Mack arrives, really establishes the Brethren, the German Baptist Brethren in America. And at the end of the last one, I had talked about, you know, tracking back the Brouwer name. There's a Christian Brouwer who is on a naturalization document in 1743, listed under a group of people who had religious exemption to signing the oath of the state because of their religious beliefs, which is very common for Mennonite, Quaker, Brethren folk. They don't take creeds. They don't make oaths. And if you track that Christian Brouwer back, he also grew up in the same region of Alexander Mack in Germany. If you're there today, it'd be, you know, like an hour and a half drive. So, you know, pretty close connection there to the Brouwer of this family and the beginning of the German Baptist Brethren. So all of those ideas are circulating there.
I wonder if somebody should take a road trip to Germantown, Pennsylvania.
Or to Germany. I have been to Germany.
Thinkling's trip to Germany.
Yeah, no.
There's a much closer historical monument that we could go to. So part three, now we're going to talk about the spreading of the German Baptist Brethren to Iowa and the English River Church. So I have a picture here.
You have a map.
Yep. And so what do you guys notice? So there's a pin, which is the English River Church. What do you notice about that map?
Well, your hometown's on there, Williamsburg, buddy.
Yes. So this English River Church of the Brethren is just south of where I grew up in Williamsburg.
How far is that? Like driving?
Is that like 10 minutes.
10 minutes. Oh, minutes. Wow. Okay.
15 minutes. And so, so here's where we start the long list of quotes. So how do we get from, you know, the Germantown Baptist Brethren to here we are in Iowa? So first I have a quote from Benjamin Franklin, talking about the German Baptist Brethren, the Dunkers. So here's the quote. "Those embarrassments that the Quakers suffered from having established and published it," speaking of a creed, "as one of their principles that no kind of war was lawful, and which being once published, they could not afterwards, however they might change their minds, easily get rid of, reminds me of what I think a more prudent conduct in another sect among us, that of the Dunkers." And this is from Ben Franklin's autobiography. "I was acquainted with one of its founders, Michael," and this, I voice detected this, so these are not spelled correctly, but Michael Wolford. "Soon after it appeared, he complained to me that grievously culminated by the zealots of other persuasions and charged with abominable principles and practices to which they were utter strangers. I told him this had always been the case with the new sect, S-E-C-T, and that to put a stop to such abuse, I imagined it might be well to publish the articles of their belief and the rules of their discipline." So Ben Franklin knows one of the early leaders of the Dunkers is trying to encourage them to like put something in writing. And here's the answer, which is pretty fun. He said it had been proposed among them, not agreed to, for this reason. When we were first drawn together as a society, he said, it had pleased God to enlighten our minds so far as to see that some doctrines, which were esteemed truths, are errors, and that others which had been esteemed errors were real truths. From time to time, he has been pleased to afford us, and our principles have been improving and our errors diminishing. There are a lot of typos here. Wow. Now we are not sure that we have arrived at the end of this progression in the perfection of spiritual and theological knowledge, and we feared that if we should once print our confession of faith, we should feel ourselves as if bound and confined by it, and perhaps be unwilling to receive further improvement, and our successors still more so, as conceiving that their elders and founders had done to be something sacred, never to be departed from. So here's Ben Franklin speaking with a dunker, like, hey, you know, why don't you put your beliefs into writing? And they're, it's in the context of like Revolutionary War, the Quakers, like mm-hmm. we can't fight. And the dunker's perspective is, well, if we put something in writing, the people after us are going to like worship that. And then it's going to hinder spiritual growth long-term. Huh. So, but to finish the quote, this modesty in a sect is perhaps a single instance in the history of mankind. This is Ben Franklin's word on the dunkers. Every other sect, supposing itself in possession of all truth, and that those who differ are so far in the wrong, like a man traveling in foggy weather, those at some distance before him on the road he sees wrapped up in the fog, as well as those behind him, and also the people in the fields on each side, but near him all appears clear, though in truth he is as much in the fog as any of them. So he points to confessional Christian or, you know, religious people thinking that they have the truth. And it's like, everybody's standing in the fog yeah. and it's like, that guy's standing in the fog, but I'm not standing in the fog. Cause I can see this little tiny ring around me. And Ben Franklin's like, the dunkers aren't like that. They are very, you know, God might enlighten us, give us more, not more revelation, but better understanding of the word. So we want to be careful. So I thought that was a very interesting quote just to give you the demeanor of these people. They're very careful when they handle the word of God. And then, so that's kind of who they are. How do we get to them spreading? So here's another quote, and this is historical, but you know, bear with me. The French and Indian War made the English supreme over North America. The Revolutionary War drove out the French conquerors and left the colonies free and independent. At once, the long stem, tired of my immigration over the Allegheny Mountains set in. First, it was hardy pioneers, then the invading army that drove the Indian to the west and north, then the agriculturalist, whose coming marked the beginning of permanent occupation. The sturdy Germans were among the first, man, there's so many typos here, first to the Ohio and Mississippi valleys. Among those pioneer farmers were many members of the German Baptist Brethren Church. They carried their principles with them, and from 1790 to 1825, the Great Central Plain was rapidly populated by the Brethren. So we started in the 1600s in Europe. Then Alexander Mack in the late 1600s, early 1700s, Brethren come to Pennsylvania. Then you have the Revolutionary War, and that and the Native American conflicts start shifting the population of America in America. And once kind of the routes are open, and this was from the history of the German Baptist Brethren in Europe and America, that big volume I found. Once this kind of happens, the very sturdy agricultural Germans are like, let's go. And so they start moving west and populate these areas. So it's in that same frame that we get them expanding into Iowa. So I have a link here for you. You guys can click it up if you want. So this is the Annals of Iowa, Elder John Moeller, the Dunkers in Iowa. He states there that the first Iowa congregation of the German Baptist Brethren is in Jefferson County, 1844. And Iowa geography, where is Jefferson County?
Isn't that way southeast?
It is southeast.
Is that where Burlington is?
So that map that I showed you where it showed the English River,
yeah.
If you kept going south and east of there, it's south and east of the English River congregation.
Oh, okay, sure.
So then, naturally, 1844 is the first congregation in Jefferson County. 1855, the English River congregation is formed. And then there's, in the same work by Moeller, he mentions that they build a second building close to North English, Iowa, in 1890. And you can see in parenthesis there, I have Pleasant Grove. If you go to Google Maps and type in Pleasant Grove Brethren Church, it is still there. That is about 5 miles from our family farm.
Wow. That is getting closer and closer.
Yep. So, and here's a quote from Moeller about this early English River congregation. Although, as noted, the first love feast was held in a straw-covered shed built for the purpose in or about 1860. Elder Jacob Brower
built
a large barn, and until the church was built, this was used to hold the communion services. Ordinary services were held in the Liberty Schoolhouse. The present church building is 40 by 60 feet and cost about $2,000.
Man, times have changed.
Yeah, and Moeller, I can't remember when he writes this, but it's a long time ago. So this Jacob Brower, you're like, oh, we found it. But the timeline doesn't match up.
Oh, boy.
So this Jacob Brower, so when you start searching for the name Jacob Brower, I found this because it's a direct hit. This would actually be the grandfather of the one who owned this Bible.
Okay. Okay.
So, and then this Jacob, who built this house, who built the worship center, his son was Peter. And Peter is the father of Jacob. And that's where we get the Peter Brower in the opening of this Bible.
No way.
And then to connect it back.
Peter is the dad, and he gave it to his son?
Yes.
Gotcha.
And so this Jacob would have been Bible Jacob's grandpa.
Yeah.
And wow. If you keep going back, I don't know if it's grandpa, great grandpa, but then Christian Brower, the one on that naturalization document, would have been the older Jacob Brower's, I think, grandpa.
Wow.
So you can kind of track it back that way. But let's keep going. So then... surprisingly enough, for a very unique, specific little thing, there are multiple resources written about the English River congregation. So you can see the links that I provided for you.
Yeah.
So I have a quote here. I just love, this gives you a feel of the area. So go back to the 1800s. What was it like to be settling in Iowa in the early 1800s? And here's the quote.
Mm.
According to notes kept by early settlers of the South English locality chosen by the Brethren, it bordered on the edge of a great prairie to the south and east, as well as on the timbered regions to the north and the west. The big prairie between there and Washington, or if you're from Southeast Iowa, is Washington.
Okay.
Yep. That's great.
If you go to Southeast Iowa, you don't wash clothes or dishes, you wash them.
If you have a farm and you have a little miniature river that's only like a foot wide, what do you call it?
Creek.
A creek, that's right.
Anyway, a creek. Keep going.
So the big prairie between there and Washington, about 25 miles southeast, was given over to deer and wolves. Now, have you ever seen a wolf in Iowa? Here's historical evidence.
Wow. I can't even get a chicken in Ankeny. You think I'm going to see a wolf?
Amen. So let's keep going.
Tim's still ticked about the chickens.
So this is an account. These are accounts of settlers. So this big area, South English to Washington, is covered by deer and wolves. The wisest of us could see no way by which this prairie could be settled, there being no way to build fences to keep warm, nor... nor to roast a wild turkey, except with the native timber. And that was above all taken up by settlers along the timberline. Another reason why the prairie might not be settled was because thousands of acres of it were underwater a good portion of the year. Just to remember that a lot of these places were very different before we got like civil engineering in modernity. Especially like, you know, this is a very small scale. But you think about like the Mississippi floodplain, how we've changed the demographics of America because we've been able to settle places that you historically could not.
Yeah, that's really good.
Anyway, covered by water a good portion of the year, but the deer and the wolves soon yielded to the settlers, of which the Brethren congregation constituted a considerable part. The tall prairie grasses gave way to crops of corn, wheat, and flax. A team of ponies, or more commonly a box, a group of oxen is what it's supposed to say. Voice of Text took oxen and made it boxen. And here we are with C.S. Lewis. Boxen. Hey, or commonly a group of oxen.
That was good, Charlie.
Is to a walking plow broke the soil. Wheat was sown in the spring, mostly on corn stubble land, without plowing. It was cut with the cradle, bound by the hand, and threshed with a chaff piler. If the chaff piler was not available, the grain was tramped, or no attention was paid to the meadows, since the wild hay could be had for cutting. Farming at first was not an overly extent, was not on a very extensive scale. 20 acres of corn, 20 of wheat, and 10 of oats was considered quite a farm.
Wow, that's not what we have today.
No. So like now today, if you're farming occupationally, probably at a bare minimum, you're talking 500 acres or more.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but if you're using cattle to work the land and you've got 50 acres.
Again, just to try to get back in the mindset of like, this is a different universe.
Yeah,
like,
for
in
real.
The 1800s and I like you, like there's 25 mile stretch of land that you can't inhabit because of the wolves. There's nowhere to, like, you can't build houses. There's no wood. It's flooded. Like, we can't even cook our meals, which we can kill a wild turkey, but what are we going to cook it with? There's no wood to burn a fire.
That's
so it's
amazing.
Interesting to think about early settling.
Yeah.
But here's this stout German Brethren that move in.
Stout or sturdy?
Like a nice German. Anyway. anyway. So now we got to get down to the end here. So. It's in this English River church that we already mentioned. There's the first, the older Jacob Brouwer. You can pull up that link and there's pages marked here. There's a picture of the first building that he builds there on page 58. And then on page 61 of that document, we do have the Jacob Henry Brouwer that's mentioned that owns this Bible. And so, this, I believe the excerpt of this was actually his obituary published in another journal, and it was pulled over into this history book. But we'll go ahead and read this. Jacob Henry Brouwer, eldest child of Elder and Mrs. Peter Brouwer, was born near South English, Iowa, January 23rd, 1879, and died at the place of his birth of influenza, February 13, 1920, age 41 years and 20 days. His boyhood days were spent on the farm, assisting his parents and attending the country school. Later, he entered the South English High School. During 1908-09, he with his family spent the year at Mount Morris College in Mount Morris, Illinois. His thirst for knowledge did not close with his school days, for he was ever interested in educational activities, spoke of his education as incomplete, and his future plans to finish his college course. His studious habits went out with him in his life, to which fact the well-chosen library of books and magazines that he gathered about him will testify. He was united in marriage to Lottie V. Kaiser, December 25th, 1901. His wife survived him only 53 hours. So she dies a couple days after he
died. Same sickness.
Wow.
Influenza. Yep. To them were born three daughters, Alma, Fern, Edna May, and Alma Fern, Edna May, and Esther Eileen. Besides these sorrowing members of his immediate family, he leaves a devoted mother, three brothers, and one sister near South English, Iowa, one sister in Mount Morris, and one brother at Louisville, Kentucky. Having accepted Christ as his Savior, he united with the Church of the Brethren in February 1891. He was chosen to the ministry November 24th, 1906, and ordained to the eldership October 25th, 1914. Always serving in offices of the church, often appointed to committees or selected as delegate to the annual or district meetings, he was ever active and enthusiastic. Brother Brouwer's interest in mission work led him to Council Bluffs in the spring of 1914. Climatic conditions were not favorable, and he returned to the farm at the end of the year. His ultimate aim, however, was the giving of his talents toward the spreading of the gospel. In pursuance of his aim, he devoted much of his time to the evangelist work in Iowa. Time and money were on the altar. As a minister of the word, his services were often in demand, up almost to the time of his death. Even in the hours of delirium, his lips still preached Christ to a lost world. Just a beautiful testimony to this man.
Wow.
And to connect all of the dots. Esther, one of his daughters, I knew Esther. She actually, she died in 2010, which is the year I graduated high school. But when I was in high school, my dad, we would go down to the apartments on the south side of Williamsburg where Joe and Esther lived. And I had no idea who these people were. But Esther was born in 1914 there, and she was of a similar age to my grandma. And her parents are dead. They're in a similar age range as my grandma. So they were raised kind of with each other in that area. And there's a main reason for that. So I think it was mentioned there. I guess it doesn't say, but Alma, the oldest daughter of Jacob, married a brewbaker. And that was Oscar Brubaker, was my grandma's dad. And so then from Oscar and Alma, you have Gene. And from Gene, you have Cliff. And from Cliff, you have Charlie. So Jacob is my great-great-grandfather.
Wow.
I didn't know when I was in high school, when I would visit Esther. It was only a handful of times, but I was visiting like a great aunt.
Wow.
In a sense. And so when I became a Christian, my grandma started telling me about how, did you know that you have a great-great-grandfather who was a pastor, was a preacher?
No way.
And I didn't believe her. But then there was one day we were, I think we're at the assisted facility in Williamsburg. She pulled out this Bible in a much poorer condition. It was like, this was his Bible. And it was not really put together. You couldn't really walk through it very well. But, and I think she had miscommunicated some details. For a long time, I thought it was John Henry. But then just recently, one of my aunts, my Aunt Linda, had it rebound and was like, Grandma Jean wanted Charlie to have this. And so like gave it to me. And
no,
I was like,
way.
Oh man, I remember this.
Wow.
And then you start pulling back the layers of it and you're like, this is incredible.
Wow.
And so it very fun to learn of spiritual heritage that you didn't know was there. And I was pretty convinced that I was like the only one.
Hmm.
And it's fun and sobering to realize that just 100 years back in my family tree is a line of pastors.
Wow.
That we read it in his obituary. What is his whole life? It's his money, his life is on the altar.
Mm-hmm.
His dying breath, he's sharing the gospel with people. And that's in a tiny little podunk, South English, Iowa. There's two buildings of Brethren churches there in near South English. They're both still there. I have relatives that still attend one of them. I think it's a very small congregation. At least a few years ago, they didn't have a pastor or an elder. And so it's very interesting to think about. I have two final thoughts. One is kind of a, what did I find in the Bible? And then the other one is trying to, what's the value of doing something like this? So what was in that Bible? When I received it, there was a separate bag and it had these newspaper clippings. And I'm going to show you. Here's what it looks like. It's old newspaper.
Oh, that's cool.
Up, and then inside of it, there is a pressed flower. And there was three of these.
Wow.
That is really cool.
Actually, I think there might have been four, but there's three that match.
He had three daughters.
And you'll notice what's the date on...
Can't see it. 1920 or something.
What? Can you see the day?
February 18th.
And if we go back to that obituary there, I don't think it was him, but the interment of his wife was on the 18th. So in a span of 3 days, you have mom and dad die.
Yeah.
And I think these were newspapers of the day they buried their mom.
Oh, yeah.
Wow.
And the three daughters kept a flower and they pressed it in the newspaper.
Oh, that's
and
cool.
It was still in that Bible. Wow. Which is just, and so like I'm holding the newspaper from the day Lottie was wow. buried, which is why, with the flower still in it.
Yeah.
So that's really cool. So it's a very interesting family heirloom to think about. But then some passages to consider in light of this. So first, doing a journey like this really changes the way you look at a genealogy.
Oh, yeah. Oh,
like,
yeah.
You read those genealogies in scripture and you're like, this has nothing to do with me. Mm. But it really, it does. Like, why would God put those in the word for us? Why would he want them to be there? And I don't want to spiritualize it, but when we get to the beginning of Matthew, there is a lot of investment into proving the lineage of the Messiah, and that in that family of God, we're connected to an ancient spiritual people. Mm. Like from the beginning of time, believers today are connected, maybe not directly physically, but spiritually in that family. And so it just made me think about like a genealogy. If you had been an original recipient of one of those letters or the writings of Moses in the Old Testament, like what would you have been thinking when you read that list and to know that your family was legitimately there? It's very interesting to peel back layers like that. Joshua 24:15, very famous verse. Does anyone know it? As for me
and my house, we will serve the Lord.
Yeah, no, I do that, yeah. That one.
As for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. And again, there's a very sobering quality here to recognizing that in the extended family, go back in the genealogy of my life, there were a lot of very devoted believers. But sobering in the sense that 100 years later, that testimony is almost gone.
Yeah.
And so it reminds me of, you know, we need to be teaching in our home what we believe. Like this is important. And how, and obviously this is a tragedy where a pastor and his wife die and he leaves behind 3 daughters. And, you know, 50, 60 years later, what's there, you know? 2 Timothy 1, Paul highlights that Timothy's faith is a result of his grandma and his mom. And so the spiritual heritage of a family, it's not your faith, it's your family, your household.
That's good.
And I'm going to read from Psalm 78 here, where it talks about the need to teach the next generation. Give ear, O my people, to my teaching. Incline your ears to the words of my mouth. I will open my mouth in a parable. I will utter dark sayings from of old, things that we have heard and known that our fathers have told us. We will not hide them from their children, but tell to the coming generation the glorious deeds of the Lord and his might and the wonders that he has done. He established a testimony in Jacob. He appointed a law in Israel, which he commanded our fathers to teach their children, that the next generation might know them, the children yet unborn. And arise and tell them to their children, so that they should set their hope in God and not forget the works of God, but keep his commandments. And that should not be like they should not be like their fathers, a stubborn and rebellious generation, a generation whose heart was not steadfast, whose spirit was not faithful to God. And you hear an echo there in verse 6, of maybe 5 and 6. The parents are supposed to teach their kids. If you go to the greatest command, love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength, right there is commanded to the parents. You need to teach your kids and your kids' kids this. And where are you supposed to teach it? Everywhere. When you're lying down, right. When you're going, you put it before your eyes, bind it on your hands. Like everywhere you go, parents, you should be telling your children about this. And again, you can see how you have multiple pastors and then one generation stops teaching that. And you skip 100 years, and then, you know, there's very few believers in my family now. And it's just such a great reminder. And I think everybody could do this. I think everybody could probably look back and find someone in their heritage that was a Christian. especially in the early parts of America, there it was very dominant that we have a Christian heritage. It should not be avoided or forgotten. But we don't rest on that heritage. We have a responsibility today to know the word and to teach it in our houses, to have a spiritual heritage. And this just really emboldened me that in my house, we can't forget these things.
That's right.
Like, there should never be a gap of where, oh, I had a great grandfather that was a pastor. Like, that vacuum should not be happening in any of our Christian homes. Mm-hmm. We should be connected to our forebears. Maybe not all the way back to German Pietism or to the Reformation. Maybe not hundreds and hundreds of years, because it's not necessarily feasible that we all know those things. But our kids, the children in our churches, should know where we came from. And they should know where we're going. And that Psalm 78, and I'll conclude with this. That the next generation might know them, the children yet unborn. My pastor in Williamsburg, when we first kind of learned about some of this, he made a statement to me that I'll never forget. He goes, "Charlie, you realize that your great-great-grandfather probably prayed for your salvation?"
That is so cool.
And that God waited 100 years to answer that prayer, but he answered it.
Wow.
And I thought, man, that's really, really fascinating to think about. That we know God is sovereign and he's chosen, but he works through the means of people. And he does answer prayer. And that here's a guy that I won't meet until glory, that he and I are probably very similar. A massive library, just wants to serve the Lord, a pastor, you know, love Southeast Iowa, know Washington, you know, we know all those little things. But that he prayed for his kids, the kids yet unborn. And I think that would be, you know, maybe a present application, is that we should be thinking about the people that will come after us, and we should be praying for those that will follow us, that they would stay true to the spiritual heritage that we have. And what a blessing it is to have a family heirloom to be reminded of those truths. But we don't all need to have, you know, an old Bible to do that. Any Bible has these same passages. And just encourage you as parents, if you're parents, or as kids, just to think about the future generations that will follow you and the example that you will set for them in your walk of faith. And so hopefully this has been enjoyable as we've talked about the Dunkers and Jacob. But thank you for listening, and we'll see you next time on the Thinklings Podcast. Thank you for listening to this episode of the Thinklings Podcast. We would love to hear from you. If you have any feedback, suggestions, or potential topics that you'd like us to discuss, you can contact us through our email, thinklingspodcast@gmail.com. Remember, don't let this conversation end with this podcast. Read good books, talk about them with your friends, and always continue to cultivate your mind. See you next time on the Thinklings Podcast.